Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology show with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And thank you, patrons, for being patrons. And if you are one, this is your extended ad-free version of the show. Thank you to some of our new patrons. We had three new patrons this week. Ken O'Kelly, Michael Saffel, and Unknown User. That is not a user who is unknown. That is their name, whoever you may be. Thank you, Unknown User. They're supporting us directly. And for just the price of a coffee or two for Ian and I every month, you can get access to our full-length show, our ad-free version. Listen and chat with us live. And get Extra Message, which is our Patreon-exclusive sister show. It's a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun in our pre-show chat for our live listeners today as well. Find out more, patreon.com/UK Tech. Ian, I hope you've had a delightful week. I've been making an episode of my Bloomberg show about the future of breast pumps and pelvic floor muscle training devices.
Interesting. Something that you're an ideal candidate to make a show about.
Well, that's actually how it stemmed. I thought, you know, am I the right person to be looking into this technology? And it turns out that being a man with no breasts and no children, it's actually quite a good person to be broadcasting about the virtues of this technology, because it's not always something that men pay attention to as
well,
a result.
Fair enough. Yes, that is so true.
Yeah. Good fun week. A couple of things before we jump into our first news story that I wanted to flag. We've talked about it before, but the £100 contactless payment limit on cards in the United Kingdom is now available, so you can get spending at a higher rate than before. And also, BT Broadband customers, if you're one of the millions who are, you can now get an Xbox Game Pass Ultimate for free. If you're on the fibre pack, we've got links to those two stories in the show notes. If you head over to uktechshow.com/episodes.
Yes, and this week has been a big week if you're in the world of smart home security devices. That's because English courts have passed a judgment on a specific case where a defendant was accused of harassing another person. It won't make video doorbells or home security cameras illegal as such. That's because a judge has ruled that one owner had used his Ring video doorbell and floodlight cameras to harass his neighbour and violate her privacy. It's a complicated ruling, but you can read it online if you're interested. The summary explains that the judge was concerned that the defendant's placement of his cameras was too wide in its scope to be legitimate, and the devices were able to record far too much of the area that would capture legitimate activities by neighbours and infringe their right to privacy. One of the really interesting things that I read in this judgment concerned specifically the use of audio on Ring and other devices. The judge said in the official document, I'm satisfied that the extent of range to which these devices can capture audio is well beyond the range of video they capture, and in my view cannot be said to be reasonable for the purpose of which these devices are used by the defendant. Since the legitimate aim for which they are said to be used, namely crime prevention, could surely be achieved with something less, a great deal of the purpose could be achieved without audio at all, as is the case with the bulk of CCTV systems in use in public places in the country. Ultimately, Judge Melissa Clark agreed that the claimant was entitled to compensation because the defendant had breached the Data Protection Act and UK GDPR. The details of the compensation will be decided at a later date. So, Nate, what is your take on this particularly complicated ruling?
Well, I think the interesting thing for me is that I've just bought a Ring doorbell.
I am shocked.
Yeah, well, we'll come back to why. I think the issue here is predominantly with sound. And one of the things that I was looking into in the ruling was that if you place this device, say, down at the end of your garden and you're able to film the neighbor's garden on either side and it's always potentially recording sound, then you are kind of, whether deliberately or not, able to record any of your neighbor's conversations in their back garden. My view on this sort of thing has always been, well, I could very easily just sit there or I could... yeah. I could hide a recorder, whereas at least with this way, the defendant in this instance had actually shown their neighbour and said, "Hey, look how fancy this all is." And the devil is always going to be in the detail. But the neighbour didn't like the fact that it could see into their garden. I think whatever happens with this case, whether it's appealed, whatever the ruling, you know, compensation ruling is, and I've heard it could be something up to like £100,000, wow, which I find extraordinarily hard to believe is justifiable. But that's for the law to judge, obviously. I just think we've got to be smart about where we place these things. This is a very good and useful reminder that protecting the privacy of your property shouldn't necessarily mean that you are invading the privacy of somebody else's. So yeah. I kind of agree that we have to be careful. In the same way as, let's say, with drones that have cameras on, there are rules with drones. You can fly a drone. You can fly a drone in a park. You can fly a drone with a camera over parents and families and children in a park. However, you cannot go close to those people. You cannot fly in front of somebody's house and their window and film in there. You cannot fly near airports, but it doesn't stop you in any way flying them, having cameras, taking pictures in public spaces. That's okay. And I sort of think it's the same here, only obviously in this instance it's, you know, screwed into your building as opposed to flying through the air. And I think that is probably a realistic comparison, let's say.
Yeah, in the live chat we're getting some questions about whether or not you'd be able to request to see the data that your neighbors had on you via an access request. It's an interesting one because obviously GDPR isn't really designed to apply to individuals. It's more designed for companies. And there was some stuff in this judgment that suggested the defendant had tried to register as a data the data officer or whatever they're
called. A data controller.
And was told that that wasn't possible at residential addresses or something. And there was some, you know, that was called into question during the ruling as well. However, it does sort of feel like the sort of thing where, you'd still be required to sort of follow the law on it, but you wouldn't be subject to the same kind of scrutiny as a business would be. So who knows what the fine will end up being based on. I mean, obviously, there's a person doesn't have a revenue, so you couldn't take 10% of that, which is the usual, you know, GDPR thing.
GDPR, it's a maximum of 4% of a company's global annual turnover, I believe, which you wouldn't be subject to if you're not a business, as you say, yeah, quite rightly. But also, I don't think you can necessarily log a subject access request under GDPR because, you know, if you are, I mean, how would the company that is holding your data, because they're stored in the cloud and Ring is encrypted now, I believe.
It can be, it isn't necessarily.
It doesn't know who the people are walking past your windows. And if it does, if it can use facial identification and it can match the image on a camera with something else that it's seen, then that raises a whole load of other ethical and privacy related questions that I don't think Amazon would want to answer. And I don't think needs to, because I just don't think this would be applicable as I understand the law as it, you know, today. The issue with sound, I get that, but this is not the only way to do this. You know, this isn't an issue over hiding microphones in your lawn. Like, if you went over and hid a small microphone and camera in your neighbor's garden, then I would say this is an open and shut case. Like, obviously, that is a massive breach of privacy. You know, there are many, many cases in the past where we've seen people install cameras in other people's houses secretly to watch them in the bathroom or whatever. And they always, you know, it's always in the defendant's interest, or rather, it's always resolved the case in favor of the defendant. Obviously, it's a breach of privacy. But I don't know. With this, I think you've got to be careful. But
you do. And I think a lot of this will have come down to the fact that the defendant in the case seemed to be somewhat belligerent. He had said that this was to defend his property and his car. He'd had a problem with a masked gang turning up and trying to steal his Audi or something, and that's why he'd gone sort of crazy on all this stuff. But the judge wasn't really satisfied with any of that, and I think he also made the crucial mistake of blathering on to literally anyone that would listen about all the stuff that he could do with his cameras. And it was that along with some other things that went on that sort of made this neighbor of his feel like she was being harassed, which I kind of totally get. And it was always that I think really rankled everyone. Like, when you read the judgment, this guy kind of feels like he's, you know, taking everything far too far. And, you know, these devices are common. I see a surprising number of Ring doorbells and other such devices around.
The way that I settled on my view on this is to think about my neighbours. You know, we get on with our neighbours. You know, we're not good friends or anything, but we never had a problem with them. However, if I saw that they, and I would encourage you all to put yourself in this position as well, if you looked over your fence in your garden and you saw that your neighbour had installed a Ring camera or a security camera that you recognised as having a very wide field of view, HD, always on, motion-triggered recording, night vision, all that sort of stuff, and you could see that it was very obviously going to be covering the whole of your garden, would you feel like your privacy was being violated? Because I would. I would feel that I wouldn't want to go out and say, I mean, I don't think I've ever been outside sunbathing topless in my garden, but when it's really hot and we're out with the dog, I should feel comfortable doing it. But if I know the camera's there, I don't know. I'm going to feel that's not really good. And John in our chat points out you can set blank zones. And the problem with the blank zones, and certainly this is the case with the Ring cameras, is the blank zones block out the camera's ability to detect you in certain areas, but it doesn't stop you being captured if something else has triggered the recording and you happen to be in that very wide field of view with the sound to go with it. So I think that's why I'm sort of on the side of the, you know, the prosecution here, just on that privacy standpoint. But I think it shouldn't be a warning to not have these cameras, or that there's anything fundamentally wrong with these cameras. It's more a case of, let's just maybe remind ourselves that we have to be smart about where we place them, and just make sure that we're not bragging about how much we can see, because that's not really going to help you, is it? There's a couple of comments in the BBC story that I saw, and the Information Commissioner's Office said, quote, lots of people use domestic CCTV and video doorbells. If you own one, you should respect people's privacy and take steps to minimize intrusion, and added, in the vast number of cases, there are no issues. Another privacy expert was quoted in this story, a pro-privacy woman called Hannah Hart. Oh, that's a lovely name. Hannah Hart said, whilst this case doesn't set a legal precedent. Oh, it doesn't. Okay, interesting. It does continue an ongoing conversation about our changing attitude towards domestic surveillance and how we normalize it in our communities. I think that's it. It's all about, these are new technologies. There are teething issues still, and we've got to just think carefully about it.
I'm interested by the fact it doesn't set precedent, because actually I would have thought that it would, but who knows? I'm sure they're more of an expert than I am. I don't know if that's because it hasn't been... Does it need to go to the High Court to do that?
Well, this is the thing. I think if it goes to the Supreme Court, but because they can overrule lower courts. So we're not... this is why we have a giant legal department at Bloomberg.
Yes, so exactly.
I don't have to think about these things. I simply call up one of the lawyers and say, what's the deal with this? Anyway, I think that's about enough on there. I know, Ian, you were curious to hear my views on why I bought a Ring doorbell, because I don't like Amazon hardware products in general. And funnily enough, largely because of privacy reasons. The reason I don't mind this one, well, the reason I chose the Ring, because I didn't want to buy a Ring. I wanted to buy a different one because I wanted it to work with Apple's HomeKit, because it gives me free, unlimited encrypted video storage, so because I didn't want to pay extra to have the recording stored in the cloud. However, I could not find a camera that A, was high quality, B, worked with Apple HomeKit, C, could work wirelessly, and D, that had a built-in battery. There are many, many combinations where you can get three out of those four. For example, you can get them that work wirelessly for data and work with HomeKit, but they have to be wired in. And you can get others that are battery powered and work wirelessly, like the Ring, but they don't work with HomeKit. So it was kind of it was an issue. And the other reason is that it, frankly, it's outside all the time. It can't see what we're doing. It can't hear us.
No, that's
and
true.
And it is, you know, it's a very limited exposure to anything we do. So it was a calculated decision to go for that. However, I would have preferred to have gone with a different brand. But at the same time, the Ring doorbell, it's really, really good. The quality is great and it works as advertised and it's not super expensive. But that was why. For the other cameras we've got, I went for a brand called, I think it's called like Aquara or something, A-Q-A-R. Something like that, I think. Got a couple of those, and they do work with HomeKit, and they're brilliantly useful. They're superbly useful. There's an extra message that is going to go out this week about my experience with those and why it's kind of paid off already for several reasons. So look forward to that, patrons. That will be in your feeds. But if you'd like your opinions to be in our inboxes on this issue, and if you've ever had any run-ins with neighbours, be wonderful to hear about how you have dealt with that or how you would deal with it. Send us an email, hello@uktechshow.com. The Hollywood Reporter, Ian. Not every week I quote a story from The Hollywood Reporter about something to do with UK technology news, but it's been a bit of a slow news week, British tech-wise, but this really intrigued me. The Hollywood Reporter wrote this week that virtual production will soon be offered as a course at one of the world's most apparently prestigious filmmaking colleges that I'd never heard of, specifically the UK National Film and Television School. In what it claims to be an industry first, in partnership with Warner Media and a couple of other places, it's set to launch a new six-month part-time certificate course, so quite limited in scope, but in virtual production. The website said that participants are going to be introduced to the core technical filmmaking required to work on virtual production projects, such as those driven by Unreal Engine, which I think, did that power The Mandalorian? Was that Unreal?
It did indeed, yeah.
Okay, so think Mandalorian here. With a course aimed at creatives from varied technical and creative backgrounds, including gaming, visual effects, 3D animation, graphic design, and people from camera that work with cameras in the camera department. Now, this does look like largely a bit of a response to the successful use of this kind of virtual filmmaking as used in the Mandalorian, which Ian can remind us about in a minute because I didn't know that much about it. But I also think maybe limited shooting options that have happened during the pandemic. You know, we've seen a lot of filming locations change or move as a result of limited travel options on occasion. And I wonder if maybe that was another reason behind moving into this space. So there's a growing deployment of this kind of filmmaking being used worldwide, and apparently the UK is taking a bit of the first stab at doing it from an educational standpoint. Now, separately, there was a press release from the school itself that said that it will be a 24-week certificate, part-time. It will start at the end of January next year. There's an application deadline of 27th of November this year for anyone who wants to get involved. There are six modules delivered weekly online as a kind of a seminar, online seminar type thing. There'll be face-to-face weekend workshops that will take place in Beaconsfield in the UK, and that's at one of the film school's sites. It's got four or five sites, one in London. I think there's one in Scotland, one in Wales, on their virtual production LED stage. And the school director, John Wardle, said, "Virtual production is quickly transforming the art and craft of filmmaking. As demand for skills in the VP landscape accelerates, being at the forefront of launching this innovative new course means we can equip creatives with the toolbox to understand how this exciting new leap in technology can help build and progress their career. I had to Google the NFTS, that is to say the National Film and Television School here in the UK. Been around for quite a long time, many decades, in fact, and at least according to one of its own white papers, 2/3 of all Netflix productions have at least one graduate in a key role from this school. And they've had people like, what was the guy who directed Ex Machina? What was his name?
Alex Garland.
Garland, yeah.
Yeah.
I think he teaches there. I think he's one of the people. So some big names. It looks really quite interesting. I'm going to look into it in more detail down the line, because I think there might be an opportunity for me to do a bit of a video about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it intrigued me that, you know, the UK's always had a big part to play in filming. You know, we've got some very, very well-used sites. I think Gravity. I think all the visual effects for Gravity was done in London. I think it might have been Framestore, but you know,
yeah, you'd be surprised. I mean, it's a huge thing for UK companies.
Yeah, absolutely massive. But I thought when I wondered, Ian, because you know quite a lot about this, how this works, as at least in how it worked for The Mandalorian.
Yeah,
can you give us a summary?
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I've found myself absolutely captivated by it because. As a byproduct of the increasing usefulness of LEDs for displays, it's now possible to build a big LED display that's high resolution enough to look good on a 4K production. So that's what they do. They build these huge LED screens, and they're used as the background. So you build a small set in front of it. They're usually sort of curved, and then so you'll have props in the foreground, so you might have a small part of the set that's physical, joined then to a virtual bit that is on the screen, and then the cameras, as they move around that volume, are tracked by there's marks on the ceiling or sensors on the camera, I believe in this case. As you move around, the 3D engine completely re-renders what the background is showing, which gives you the ability through the camera to see a proper parallax 3D effect, giving it this kind of depth that you wouldn't get otherwise, and it looks indistinguishable from a real background in many cases. There's lots of demos you can watch online, and they all sort of have various sort of forest scenes and stuff like that. Obviously, they don't work with people necessarily, because you'd have to render those people and that would look terrible. But where you're sort of, and that's why it works with The Mandalorian, because you've got these stark planet backgrounds that have nothing on them. But you can easily shoot a lot of the action in front of them. And the same with space, of course. You know, it's quite easy to generate a star field on an LED screen and then, have it move as the camera moves. It's fantastic and it looks incredible. And for some kinds of production, it is going to be a huge deal.
This is better than using a green screen then, presumably, because it allows the actors in front of the set to actually see what's going on or feel a bit more immersed in it.
And absolutely, and that will be a huge part of it, because it will give you if you're in space, you'll actually feel like you're in space. I mean, that would be quite a powerful acting tool, I should think. That said, it's much more important than that, because what it does is, because the volume has LEDs all around you, including on the ceiling, it enables you to have reflected light from the things that are happening around you. So, for example, one of the reasons it works for The Mandalorian is they decided that they would have that stupid silver helmet for him. Now, in TV and film, normally you would avoid something like the plague, because it would be so hard to sort of, remove aspects that you didn't want. Or if you were using a green screen, you'd then have to put those reflections back on the helmet in post-production, which would be hell. I mean, a lot of green screen work is hell anyway. Like, people just sort of think, green screen, I could just put what I want there. It is so much more involved than that for film production. It's not the same as if you're sort of, doing a game stream, but it's the reflected light that makes a huge difference. So, everything in that area has light reflected as it would be in the actual scene. So rather than having to faff around putting up little key lights here and, trying to fake it, you're actually getting reflected light, so you can have a specific kind of sky, all that kind of stuff. It's really very clever.
And I suppose that's why the companies like Unity are so heavily involved and why this particular course is aimed as well at people in the games industry, because it's not just about filmmakers learning how to key in different backgrounds on a green screen. This is about how do you, it's about how do you make what is being displayed on it. It is how do you direct actors who are performing in front of it, and as you say, with the reflections, how can you benefit in a way that you couldn't necessarily benefit with green screen, that actually helps the visual component of your storytelling come to life even more? I think it's super interesting.
Really, really interesting. And I'm, you know, and I feel like this will be a huge deal. I mean, as I said, it's not going to be suitable for every kind of production, but it certainly could be. It really does make things like, you know, scenes in cars and stuff like that, you know, you can give it a lot more life, and, you know, and turn it into something that, whereas before it would have looked really unnatural, you're going to get...
Let me interrupt you briefly, because this is one of the things, when you look back on old films, and you see this a lot in sitcoms, there's some fantastic examples in Friends, actually, the TV show Friends, where, you know, you're in a car, and obviously the car is a real car, or is at least a very convincing model.
Well, yeah, half a car or something.
Like half a car, exactly. And it's on set. And obviously the background is either green screen or it's a video that's just been played. And you can always, always tell. Like there's nothing you can do. You can always tell because the bouncers don't line up, or the light doesn't line up, or the turning of the steering wheel, you know, that fake steering doesn't line up. They're not paying attention to cars passing by. Like, it's so obvious. And it feels like this is exactly that kind of technology that you can get a much more realistic looking result than anything that came before it, other than obviously going actually out and shooting, which hasn't been particularly easy over the last couple of years.
No,
for obvious reasons.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there are always some things that you can do to make those things look more natural. I mean, like the wiggly steering wheel thing is just an acting problem. You know, it's like people just feel like they need to be moving the wheel, but obviously we know that's not how you drive a car. It also makes budgets a little bit more flexible, because in order to do a car scene out in public, normally if it was just sort of a scene set in a car and not a chase or anything like that, you'd usually tow that car around. So you put it on a very low loader, and someone drives a truck and they drive the car around, and that's how you get the scene. So it's actually happening, but it's, you know, done in a safe way so that the person who's acting doesn't have to also be driving, because that would be ludicrous. Obviously things are different for, you know, when you're doing stunt work. But then, you know, imagine that instead of having to rent a truck and go out and do location shoot, you just do it in a volume instead, and it will look as good, and you know, you could use pre-captured footage and all that kind of stuff, and it would have all the authenticity of actually being out and about and doing stuff. So it's a clever idea.
Well, if you want to learn more about this, now you can. You've got another month, a bit over a month, if you want to go and apply to this at the film school. We'll include a link to the Hollywood Reporter article. We'll include a link to the press release we discussed, and a couple of links as well to the school if you want to have a look around it. I frankly find I've learned so much in just researching this little story, just about how film schools actually teach what they do. In my head, it's always just been sitting in a lecture room learning about mise-en-scene, but actually no, there's these giant sets and editing suites and cameras and everything. It's really quite fascinating, hence wanting to talk about it today during this slow news week. Any thoughts you have on this, if you're going to apply, drop us a line, hello@uktechshow.com. Well, Ian, I think it is time we check in with our good friend Tom Merritt, who's going to tell us what's been happening in the wider world of tech news this week. Are you ready?
Are you steady? Yes.
Here it comes.
This week on Daily Tech News Show, a Swiss student shoves a USB-C port inside an iPhone with a clever bit of reverse engineering. Your move, Apple. Amazon gets accused twice of abusing its position on its own platform, and U.S. lawmakers target it, Apple, and Google with a bipartisan bill to outlaw that and other monopolistic practices. And the sad tale of a Missouri governor who used geek outrage to get political attention. Right-clicking is not, in fact, a crime. All that and much more at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Thank you, Tom.
I love that story about right-clicking, not being a crime. That is one of the funniest things. I live for those politicians getting stuff technically wrong. It's brilliant.
I love it, yeah. It always reminds me of the internet being a series of tubes. God rest his soul. I think he died.
He may have done.
I can't remember his name. Good question. An American senator, I believe, but he passed away. Anyway, thank you, Tom. For our regular listeners, you may not have heard our very, I think, interesting explanation of what the metaverse is. You may have heard it. You're certainly going to hear an awful lot more about it over the coming months, years, and potentially decades. If you want to get the full version of our show and listen to that extra story all about how the metaverse works as we understand it today, that is available to patrons at patreon.com/UKTech. Sign up, go and listen to that. No ads, so on and so forth, are in that. So, Ian, I think that's going to actually wrap it up for this week. We did have a very interesting email came in from from listener Peter, who wanted to know more about the Sky Glass. Some very interesting questions about things like what happens to my dish and has it got a hard drive and can it output Dolby Atmos and things? And I can assure you, Peter, that Ian is on the case getting answers for these things, because we want to get one of these units in. We want to do some testing and use your questions as the basis of an episode or an extra message or similar.
Yeah, very much so.
We're not ignoring you, Peter. Thank you for the great question. We will be coming back to that as soon as we can. And we'll be coming back to everybody else in a week's time. Have a delightful week, everybody. Ian, I hope you stay slinky, stay safe, and please, please keep your ponytail, because I love you slightly more than I did before now.
You've had long hair, haven't you?
Yeah, many times. Yeah,
Hell on earth.
I disagree. Oh. It suits you very much.
No, it doesn't. I hate it. I absolutely hate it. I can't promise it's staying, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, I could say the same about this episode. It's not staying. It's going. Bye, everybody.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.